All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And this just broke right after we went on the air with our previous guest, Greg Gordon. The U.S. government is accusing the Iranian government of being behind a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. And according to the crawl on CNN International, this was to be the first of a series of attacks. And all I'm here to tell you is that everything the government says is a bunch of lies, and there's no reason to believe this, and just compare it against what you know about Iran having no ability to wage any conventional war in North America whatsoever or get a single one of their boats anywhere near our coast. And they know for a fact that our Navy can sit off of their coast indefinitely and bomb them, even with nukes if we feel like it, off the face of the earth. The idea that they would try to start a war with us like this right now is preposterous. Don't you believe it for a second. I mean, could be true. I'm just saying, don't give them the benefit of the doubt at all. They're liars and murderers, and this has already been proven to be true right in front of your eyes over and over again. All right, now to our next guest. It's the great Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. Everybody, as you may know, Adam writes from Cairo, Egypt, where there's been a lot of bloodshed and attacks by you tell me who against a bunch of Coptic Christians at a demonstration over the weekend.
Yeah, well, the situation is getting really, really confusing. The whole 9 month aftermath of the Egyptian revolution, things have just become increasingly confused. People have become increasingly divided. So the situations are becoming harder and harder to read. The latest incident, to understand the latest incident, you have to go back about 10 days to when you had an incident in Upper Egypt in the governorate of Aswan, where local Coptic Christians apparently were attempting to convert a church, or attempting to convert a building of some kind into a church, either with a license or without a license. The verdict is still out on whether or not they had an official license from the government to convert this building into a church. And basically you had local Muslim residents basically objecting to the building of this church and eventually knocking down some additions to this building that had been made to this church. And this caused uproar in the Coptic community and basically resulted in a big protest march in Cairo on Sunday. And that protest march basically, the upshot was that protest march was apparently fired upon by the ruling military, by the armed forces, which have controlled the government since Mubarak's ouster in February. Now, details of exactly what happened, however, remain extremely ambiguous, and I still have not been able to determine who exactly was responsible for triggering the violence. There are basically three trains of thought. The Christians are basically saying that they were just staging an entirely peaceful march when they were brutally shot upon by soldiers. And there's a second line of thought, but basically a second theory in which, and with eyewitnesses also to testify to it, basically saying that there were armed elements within the protest who had started the violence and had fired on army personnel and therefore were fired back at. And then there's a third line of thought as well strange elements that weren't from either side basically managed to infiltrate the march and basically got the two sides to shoot at one another. What exactly the truth is still open to question. Emotions are running extremely high here, and people are doing there's been a lot of fiery rhetoric from both sides. People are saying things in anger without fully understanding the facts. So the situation has gotten a little bit choppy here. But we do know that at least 25 people were killed on Sunday night, though, and hundreds were injured in the melee.
All right. Well, fill me in on the tradition here, because there are how many, what, millions of Coptic Christians in Egypt, and typically everybody gets along more or less okay, right?
Well, yeah, this is the very interesting thing. You've basically got a population of roughly 80 million, an estimated 10% of which are Christian. There aren't exact figures because under the former regime of Hosni Mubarak, sort of liked to keep things ambiguous. I think it worked in their favor to not ever actually know exactly how many Christians there were. But there, until now, nobody knows the precise numbers, but they're estimated at 10% of the population. Now, that 10% of the population has traditionally lived with the Muslim majority in peace for more than 1,000 years. It was only until about 10 or 15 years ago that you started to see these sectarian incidents, these sectarian flare-ups, mostly in Upper Egypt. They would often involve church building or unlicensed church building, or sometimes they just had to do with feuds between rival families, that one family just happened to be Muslim and one family just happened to be Christian, over land, for example, that would eventually take on a sectarian flavor, even though the original problem might have been a non-sectarian issue. Now, episodes like that would occur maybe once every 5 years. That was like where I'm talking now, 80s, 90s. Now, within the last 10 years, the tempo of these sort of sectarian conflicts has accelerated to the point where over the last decade, you had something happening about once a year. You would have some kind of serious incident, again, usually in Upper Egypt, but not necessarily, sometimes in Alexandria, sometimes in Cairo. So the last 10 years of the Mubarak regime basically saw a speed up in the tempo of these sectarian problems. And that basically culminated in the bombing of a church. I'm sure you remember this. It was only January of this year. It seems like longer ago, considering everything that's happened. But it was only in January of this year, New Year's Day, actually, when a church in Alexandria was bombed, and Muslims were blamed, and it caused a huge hue and cry here at the time.
Well, and everybody thought at the time that Mubarak did it, right?
Well, what was interesting, nobody really suggested that, at least in the mainstream. Nobody suggested that when it happened. But what happened was it was only weeks after that the revolution broke out. And during the revolution, you had all different sorts of crazy things happening. You had these top secret government documents that were coming to light. You had police stations being stormed. You had the interior ministry offices were being stormed, and these documents were falling into the hands of people. And one of the interesting bits of information to have emerged during that whole 18-day period was apparently there were two people who had worked for the interior ministry who sought refuge at a foreign embassy, and basically they told the story that they had been a part of the bombing, that they had somehow been involved in the bombing, and that it was in fact an interior ministry led operation. Now, if that's true, and this is, as usual, this is one of these incredibly interesting, tantalizing stories that just sort of falls off the radar screen, you know, given everything else that's happened, especially in the Middle East and in Egypt in the last 9 months. It's one of these things that was never adequately investigated, and there was never any real follow-up. I'd like to look into it a little bit more, because if it was proven, if what these guys said was true, then it would indicate that there was an official policy on the part of the former regime to instigate sectarian strife, and their motives would be clear. If that was the case, their motives would be clear, because basically they would be allowed to give them the justification for clamping down on the citizenry with these emergency laws and all of these draconian measures that they had. You know, Egypt has been under an emergency law for 30 years, for the entire duration of the Mubarak regime. And this basically would give them an excuse. They could then tell their foreign critics, they could then tell human rights organizations and things like this, well, look, if we remove the emergency law, we're going to have a situation where Muslims are going to attack Christians, and all hell is going to break loose, basically, if we ease up.
All right. Now, hold right there, Adam. We got to go out to this break. It's Adam Morrow, live on the phone from Cairo, Egypt, talking about the state of the revolution. Of course, we all remember Copts and Muslims protecting each other and protesting together in Tahrir Square just a few months ago.
That's exactly right.
A lot more along these lines. We get back with Adam Morrow right after this, everybody. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm on the line with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. He's in Cairo, Egypt, reporting on the state of the revolution. And now, Adam, I'll tell you, I don't know, man. I'm pessimistic about this thing. It seems like the elections were supposed to be a month ago. The military council rules the place. My imagination, if not journalism, informs me that CIA and Joint Special Operations Command guys are running wild all over Egypt by the thousands, manipulating events as much as they can and maintaining their dominance over the military council that now rules the country, again under those emergency laws. At Panetta's insistence, they were re-implemented, I think, just a few weeks ago. And it seems
That's
to
right.
me like the revolution is lost. Talk me out of it. Please.
Well, I would agree with what you said for the most part. I don't think this ruling military council is independent in the sense that it's actually making its own decisions, or in the sense that it has the best interests of the Egyptian public at heart. I think that it was the way it came into power, if you'll recall, in midway through the 18-day uprising, when police were actually in the early days, when police were withdrawn from the streets of, they were withdrawn nationwide, actually. They pulled out the hated police forces and they deployed the military in the streets of Egypt's cities. And if you remember that point, you had this very dramatic, these very moving displays of protesters hugging, and embracing these soldiers on the tops of tanks, and it was the idea was that the army was coming in basically to save the public from the police. You had this good cop, bad cop situation where the police were very bad, and these army guys were, you know, were seen as, like I said, were seen as protecting the revolution. The public basically gave them a mandate. They received a mandate from the public to run the nation's affairs, which they've been doing ever since. But in retrospect now, it looks like it was, you know, I don't know how else to describe it other than a psychological operation. Basically, the police failed to keep the people down with the use of force and with the use of fear. And so basically the next line of defense basically to maintain the status quo was to win over the hearts and minds of the public and to win them over with love and smiles and hugs and kisses. And that seems to have been exactly what happened. They received this mandate to run the country for a transitional period, which seems to be getting longer and longer, and yet most of the revolution's goals or demands remain unanswered. You still have this emergency law remains in effect. As you mentioned, it was just reactivated a couple of weeks ago. You have civilians are still being brought before military tribunals or military trials, which is a practice that revolutionaries had said must end with Mubarak's ouster, and that those are still going on. You still have certain foreign policy issues. For me, I think the Gaza thing is incredibly important. The siege on the Gaza Strip, which Egypt is contributing to by closing off its northeastern border, still remains in effect, and it's actually one of the things that, despite a lot of talk after the revolution, how all of these foreign policy issues were going to be addressed, seems to have fallen off of the radar again. And because of all the domestic problems, now nobody's talking about Gaza anymore. And yet this coastal enclave remains the biggest prison on the planet. So there was also talk, if you recall, immediately afterwards about relaunching diplomatic relations with Iran, which have been suspended since 1979. That also has not come to the fore again either. That seems to have been forgotten as well. So just if you just sort of sit down and look at what exactly has changed since Mubarak has left and this new military council has taken over. There's really not much to boast about. You know, you really can't point to many achievements up until now. And what's more is the head of the ruling council, this military council, was Mubarak's defense minister for 20 years. So everybody else, you know, a lot of other people who might have been associated with the former regime have been booted out, and some of them are sitting in prison, etc. But the guy who's effectively running the country, nominally anyway, the head of this council, was a defense minister under Mubarak for more than two decades. So I think your pessimism is justified.
Well, Adam, what if I, or one, thought that perhaps the State Department types decided, say, a year ago or more, that, look, Hosni Mubarak's an old man. He's got to go sometime, and we have to be prepared for the next regime after that. Let's bankroll some NGOs and some young democracy Twitter, Facebooker types, and let's get us a revolution started and, you know, adopted the Richard Perle, Laurent Marowak thesis that what we need is Egypt, the prize.
Right. Well, this is. Are you suggesting that the actual revolution itself might have been kicked off by
yeah,
by
why not? We've seen the CIA bankroll color-coded revolutions and their associated NGOs in Serbia and in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Kyrgyzstan, an attempted one in Lebanon, and
right,
you know, regime
absolutely.
Change short of invasion. It seems to be
right,
the policy.
Right.
Maybe they did it to themselves here.
Right, right. It's a very good point, but I don't think that's exactly what happened. I do think that the Egyptian revolution, unlike some of the other revolutions that might be going on in the region now, I do think the Egyptian revolution was an organic grassroots event, mainly because, I mean, I lived through it, and I saw it unfold minute by minute, and I knew some of the people that were involved, and I don't think that it was manipulated from, I don't think it was triggered by external forces. Another reason is if you call the reaction of the United States, the United States didn't act like it was expecting this. The United States really acted like it was really seemed to have been surprised by the Egyptian revolution.
And
their response
was ham-handed too, you know, trying to put Suleiman in there and Hillary Clinton warning the protesters that they better restrain themselves and all these things. Didn't seem like a
psyop.
It seemed more like a giant series of blundering reactions.
Yeah, exactly. It really seemed like it took the U.S. off guard, that they didn't know how to react, and I thought it was funny because it really showed up the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy now, in that they wanted to maintain their image as being pro-revolution and pro-democracy protesters and all of this sort of thing, mm-hmm. while at the same time it was obvious that they really wanted to keep their boy Hosni Mubarak in place, who had served them so well for so long.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dick Cheney. Hosni Mubarak's buddy up until a little while ago, he took credit for the Egyptian revolution, and I thought that he kind of had a point, at least in that certainly the invasion of Iraq more than anything helped radicalize the people of Egypt and make them detest their own government for being our government's lackey even more. And then also, of course, all the inflationary money that was created by the Fed in order to make the Iraq war seem free for the first little while there helped to make people hungry and go out there and protest and shout in the street over the fact that their local currency is being devalued in order to keep pace with the devaluing American dollar.
Right, right, right. Well, I mean, the neocons were very good at playing this double game where they pose themselves as these champions of democracy while at the same time underhandedly supporting these dictators.
And yet they're so clumsy that they end up getting somewhat of the results they wanted just by way of overreactions to their bad policy sometimes, it seems.
Right, right, right. So I do believe the Egyptian, that's a very good point that you made, though, because it's very important. I mean, if you sort of understand the way the world looks, you really have to ask how, you know, these political events that appear to be spontaneous, as we now know, are very often, you know, the work of people behind the scenes pulling the strings.
Yeah. Although usually, like in the case of Ukraine or Kyrgyzstan or something like that, you know, the Freedom House and the National Endowment for Democracy and all them, their role is a lot more blatant. And I guess I do know that the State Department was trying to bankroll some pro-democracy so-called factions in Egypt, but I don't think that this is what they wanted out of them.
Right, exactly. I mean, they were definitely doing that. There was definitely an issue of foreign funding of NGOs. America was definitely making lots of sounds about funding pro-democracy people. And there were even some of these groups had even apparently gone to the States on the State Department's dime to get training in social media and stuff like this. But that simply wasn't enough. What they were providing simply wasn't enough to trigger a massive national revolution. And also the role of the sort of these young internet savvy revolutionaries, I think, has been grossly exaggerated in the sense that the most of the people that were going toe to toe with the police at the height of the uprising, when firebombs were being thrown and police vans were being thrown off of bridges and stuff. I mean, these were just average workaday Egyptians who were probably making less than $200 a month to support their families of five.
Tell me fast, Adam, the music's playing,
even,
we gotta go. Tell me yes or no, are there going to be free and fair elections of any kind anytime soon?
I wouldn't hold your breath.
All right. Thanks very much. IPSnews.net for the journalism of the great Adam Morrow. Thank you.
Thanks,
see you tomorrow.
Scott.